You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's date being the 21st of January, 2026. I'm actually re-recording this. We had a technical problem before, but I don't mind because the issue is important. And studying it is it still has relevance for today. The title is "For There Is No Power But From God, the Russian Orthodox Church Support of the February Revolution." And it's something that I'm embarrassed to say I really didn't know until maybe 10 years ago, that the Synod of the Orthodox Church of Russia backed the provisional government. Remember, the February Revolution is the provisionals, October is the Bolsheviks. Very, very different from each other, but one led to the other. The Russian church was in the midst of a severe ideological crisis on the eve of the February Revolution. The Tsar allegedly abdicated on March 2nd, which, of course, the calendar still makes it February, but I don't believe he actually did. If you read my book on the murder of the royal family, I go into great detail as to why the abdication paper is completely invalid and nonsensical. It was written by his Nicholas's military commanders, which is a fairly common point of view in Russia today. The big issue was dissatisfaction with the synodal system. In other words, what Peter created. Although that also could be an excuse. You had people from bishops from many ideological backgrounds saying the same kind of thing, although for very different reasons. It was extremely unpopular. It was unpopular when Peter enforced it on everybody and Prokopovich. And speaking of which, I am working on another book on Peter's attack on the church, well, really the Petrine attack on the church throughout the 18th century. So these things are often very uncomfortable for Russian Orthodox people to grasp. So before we get into anything, I want to say just the three general reasons for this. Then we'll get into some details here. Of course, first, the Petrine system. They wanted a local council called immediately, although that does not necessarily mean that everyone who wanted that wanted a patriarch. The second is the parish question. That affected the majority of the clergy, the parish clergy, because they had no income of their own. They were not allowed an income of their own. Not allowed property of their own. They were on state salaries, which were far too low for normal life. And finally, the so-called dark forces on church policy, and that really comes down to Gregory Rasputin. And many of you realize that I have I've defended him. He is not what is commonly said about him. He simply isn't. I spent a lot of time on him because he is one of the main foci for revolutionary propaganda at the time, both provisional and Bolshevik. So quickly, I want to go through that. Now, I've had several recordings on Rasputin. But he is definitely the most controversial. There's so many lies that have been uncovered about him. As many of you know, the provisional government itself has its own inquiry into the functioning of the czarist system, led to almost a complete exoneration of it, including Rasputin personally. It was said that Metropolitan Petrim or Makarios of Petrograd and Moscow, respectively, they were Rasputin's protégés. Well, he didn't have protégés. And yet, they were, the higher and lower clergy were convinced of his all, you know, overwhelming power, influence on church and state affairs. He didn't. If he did, Russia would never have entered World War I, as many of you also know. The propaganda was very severe. Archbishop Nikon Rodosvensky stated that one is becoming afraid for the church. The Kilist is in charge of everything. What he means by that, Kilisti, is the an occult movement to whip themselves. That's what the word means. And even the great Anthony Krapovitsky said, if God permits this revolution, it will be punishment for the preferring Kilistism to orthodoxy. He wrote that to another great man, Bishop St. Andre Uktomsky, in November of 1916. These were holy men, but in this case, they were in error. Although, you know, through no fault of their own. Bishop Alexei spoke with Rasputin and concluded that, quote, the case of the peasant Rasputin's membership in the Kilisti sect was initiated without sufficient grounds. He was an intelligent, spiritual-minded man, seeking the truth of Christ, capable, when necessary, of offering good advice to those in need, unquote. With an assistant chief prosecutor or over-procurator, the Holy Synod, Prince Zavakov, who also was a defender of Rasputin, he said that the attacks on him were carried out on a large scale, but the forces behind it were, quote, great and powerful. He called it the international. Something along, like when I say the word regime, he means kind of the same thing. Back then, it meant international Freemasonry. Kerensky himself was a member of the Grand Orient of Russia's, technically it was the Grand Orient of Russia's peoples, just an offspring of the Grand Orient Lodge. And remember, Kerensky ruled with Pavel Milukov. That man also had Trotsky released from his holding cell in Canada. Oleg Platonov argued that society perceived Rasputin as a pious peasant, an Orthodox man. But that changed when very powerful men spread lies about him in the press. And the press in Russia at the time was incredibly corrupt. I mean, you know, it's always been corrupt. But since there was really no censorship anymore, all that meant was that Jewish power and just the worst of yellow journalism took over. The nasty things that they made of him, and including the worst, that he was a lover of the empress. Of course, none of it was true. The headquarters of that organization was in the Petrograd Yacht Club, which is just perfect. They organized the persecution of Rasputin, then, of course, his murder. That was a way to attack the monarchy. Some of these men even were considered right-wing. In the sense, they were anti-revolution. But as it turns out, the enemies of Rasputin were the enemies of the monarchy. The man did nothing wrong. The man didn't want to be there. The man would rather be working in Siberia in his village. You know, when he was murdered, it was discovered that his bank account had nothing in it. He had very little power in political decisions, but yet they created this image, which is absolutely absurd. The outbreak of unrest in Petrograd, say roughly February 26, 1917. The synod was called. The chief prosecutor at the time was Nikolai Raev. Many hierarchs were absent. The leading member of those who were there was Metropolitan St. Vladimir of Kiev, murdered by the Bolsheviks. He issued an appeal to the population, said he should avoid generalities, but rather address specific events of the moment and serve as a stern warning to the church, entailing ecclesiastical punishment in the event of disobedience. The church must not stand aside from unfolding events. All this nonsense, but the church not being political, well, that depends on the situation. When I say political, I don't mean, you know, elections and voting. I'm talking about issues of justice. There, the church has much to say. Metropolitan Vladimir responded to that general order. Well, he said, it's always like this. When we are not needed, we're ignored. But in times of danger, we're the first to be turned to for help. No appeal was ever issued for that reason. And there's no reason to distrust Zivkovsky's testimony. There is all the information to be found in the All Russian Church and Social Herald, February 27th, 1917. The chief prosecutor, Raev, he had a request to condemn the unrest. And then the synod members who were there basically said the question of where the treason comes from above or from below, is highly debatable. But once the phony abdication was submitted, the provisional government took over. This was the first meeting after that was March 4th. They developed a resolution as a prayer to God for calming the passions with the offering of many years of the God-protected Russian state and the pious provisional government. The pious provisional government was very deeply Masonic, as many of you know. On March 9th, they gave their official view of it, and I will talk about that in a little bit. But there was no, at that meeting or any earlier ones, there was absolutely no hostile opinions stated on the revolution at all. Now, there's a professor at the time, Boris Titlinov of Petrograd University. He says, on the first days of the revolution, the church authorities apparently showed a willingness to accept the coup that had taken place, apparently not just out of fear, but out of conscience. And that's confirmed by the position of the diocesan bishops. Most during the first half of March of 1917 issued encyclicals to their flocks, their people, explaining the events taking place, supporting fully the provisional government. And I've read most of these, and it's very painful to read. And it really can be divided in one of two ways. The first are, you know, enthusiastic. You know, this is a beautiful thing. And the old regime was evil, and et cetera. And the second was just a call to submit, to the new authorities, just and nothing else. One of the former, those who enthusiastically supported it, was Bishop Serafim Tchagov of Tibet, who was so excited that he sent a personal letter to Vladimir Lvov, who was the first prosecutor of the Synod appointed by the new state on March 3rd, saying, "My heart burns with the desire to come to the State Duma and to embrace the friends of the Russian people and the Russian Church, Mikhail Rodzianko, you, and other fighters for the honor and dignity of Russia." He also said that the episcopate was, quote, offended by the dominance of the Rasputinites and wished to watch itself of all the filth and corruption. As it turns out, Rasputinite was just another word for monarchist. And that became a propaganda tool at the time. With the help of the new state, he removed Metropolitan Pitrim, Petrograd, and Makary Nevsky from Moscow, based solely on the idea that the press had said that they had links with Rasputin. That's it. The press was deciding who was who should be there and who shouldn't be there. The new state was an oligarchy and a Masonic one. Serafim wrote in another message to his people, he said, "By the grace of God, the popular uprising against the old order in the state, which brought Russia to the brink of destruction, occurred without numerous casualties, and Russia easily transitioned to a new state system." You know, one of my favorite writers of that era who actually died a natural death. The old believer, but he was still a part of the official church, Andrei Udmovsky of Ufa. According to Metropolitan Uvlogi, who that one of Paris, you know, said he thundered throughout Russia with his liberalism. Well, he was anything but, and you have to watch these labels. He was anything but a liberal. It's interesting to note the attempt was made to hold Bishop Andrei accountable for articles inciting hostility to the government several days before the start of the revolution, February 19th, 1917. He came to regret that point of view. He said, in a letter, he said the old regime was unprincipled, sinful, and immoral. Autocracy degenerated into blatant and arbitrary power, surpassing all probability. Claiming that the church had long since turned their backs on, I mean, the state had long turned their backs on the church, and because of Rasputin, subject to open mockery. You know, this was an era long before the web. They only had the press and each other, especially in the distant diocese for, you know, go to for information. Right after the revolution, St. Andrei was, he couldn't have been more excited, but then very quickly he realized his error. Just like Klapovitsky, he repented. And he said, "We had one Rasputin before 1917, but now we have a national disaster, complete and total Rasputinism." Another one was Bishop Nikon, Besunov, of Krasnoyarsk, who was actually a member of the Fourth Duma. He was very excited about the revolution, or really the abdication, I should say. He sent congratulatory telegrams to Rodzianko, Prince Lvov, Guchov, and the chief prosecutor of the Synod, Lvov. At where he was a bishop, Krasnoyarsk City Duma, Bishop Nikon was elected as a member of the Committee of Public Safety. Now, the very fact that they have a Committee of Public Safety, they have a central one and they have regional ones, should tell you what this revolution was. had nothing to do with freedom. But here's what he said. On March 4th, the enemy of the Russian people, certain representatives of the old regime, have reached the limit of their lawlessness and have exhausted the patience of the state. The state Duma and the people's representatives. The newly born regime needs our complete trust, our every support. Fathers, brothers, sisters, this torn, exhausted mother calls for help. Let us abandon all selfish and party calculations. Let's calmly work for our motherland, for the army, for victory, for prosperity, and eternal peace throughout the world. That's what the revolution is going to bring, according to him. So these were the bishops who just were falling over themselves. They ideologically supported all of this. He even said, I almost lost faith in our Russian church, but now I'm coming back to life. Well, it wasn't that long afterwards he gave up his rank and married. Now, of course, I have nothing to say. I did that, but for a very different set of reasons. A much younger Archbishop Evlogi of Volin, who was the infamous Evlogi of Paris, he was a bit more reserved. And he said something strange. He said, now is not the time to argue about autocracy. Well, this is the perfect and exact time to argue about autocracy. I don't know what he means by that. Don't kick a man when he's down. I assume he means Nicholas II. He said there's a very great difficulty in Russia to renounce the idea of autocracy. Then he says, this private idea, that is to say, the idea of autocracy, unfortunately, it has no practical application in our Russian reality. Since the Russian Tsar was surrounded by a tight ring of irresponsible and dark influences. Now, these translations are mine, so I take full responsibility for their content. All of this surrounds the person of Rasputin. These guys believe the lies about him. But when you talk about the Russian bishops at this period of time, it seems outrageous that they would support an openly Masonic state. And there are many factors at work that might explain their action or their lack of action. And I've come up with a few. I've come up with 11. There's always a lot of variables to consider when you're talking about what these bishops may say or what they might not say. First of all, very importantly, the lying media used Rasputin to discredit the old state. That's the most outrageous thing of all, and they believed it. Second, the belief that the abdication was real. And keep in mind, number three, according to this abdication document, that Nicholas commanded obedience to the Masonic state, the provisional government, which is one of the reasons you know it's not real. Number four, the belief that an elected assembly, which is what they were looking forward to, would elect a new monarch in the near future, which really is number five, the same thing. The belief that the abdication was only temporary. Number six, they also had a lack of knowledge about leftist ideology and tactics, which was common at the time, although there's no excuse for that given their knowledge of the French Revolution. Number seven, their belief in Rasputin's power in the Kremlin, whether it was real or not, and most believed it was real. Eight, they were getting conflicting information or no information at all. Nine, as always, the left were lying about their intentions, so it's easy to make mistakes in this case. And number 10 is something very few people talk about, the extreme PTSD of the population. Millions have been killed at this point. Every family had a son, no daughters, a son, who was killed in the war. And of course, 11, the simple fear of retribution, although the state was never strong enough to do that the way the Bolsheviks did, of course. These are all basic variables that you have to understand when a bishop at the time supported the whites or did not. Unfortunately, there were very few that did not. See, Archbishop St. Kirill Smirnov of Tambov, a close friend of St. John of Kronstadt, there was no his political and ideological record is impeccable. His holiness, no doubt, murdered by the Bolshevik. And yet, he issued a leaflet with a message calling for loyalty to the new government. And by basically saying that we should obey the authorities acting in his name. Because within the abdication document itself, it says, I order you, my people, to obey what comes after me. However, he also said that this revolution was an act of vaudeville. It's interesting he would say that in Russia. And it would disappear like smoke tomorrow. And of course, in that case, he was absolutely incorrect. There was tremendous confusion here with all of this. We're only talking about a couple of weeks here, maybe just a few days. You know, I don't know how we function without the internet. You know, that there's the getting information was very difficult. But the chief prosecutor, Lvov, was empowered by the provisional government to make sure all the bishops fell into line. Pretty soon, Kirill realized his error. And very quickly rejected the provisional government. And he wrote to Lvov, he said, it's been officially communicated to you that I've resolutely opposed the provisional government and the new state system. The appeal I published did take place, but at a time when there was no talk of a provisional government and a new state. And that's another issue. There was a time period between the so-called abdication and the formation of the Kerensky government. A lot of these men just figured there'd be another monarch, I mean, another relative that would just take over. So he received an invitation from the governor to attend an emergency meeting. You know, I thought the church was irrelevant. I guess it wasn't. So you'll hear from all the academics, the church doesn't matter. And yet look at the effort they're putting out here. Remember, there's the State Duma Executive Committee, and then there's the state, or the provisional state. Two different things, essentially one object. The State Duma was going to turn into this constituent assembly, which was a disaster. The governor basically asked him to appeal to his people, calling for calm. And he did that, which was published in the newspaper, the local newspaper. But he was a little worried about his future. I mean, he said, well, I said these things when the provisional government didn't exist, the new state system didn't exist. We remember it was supposed to be Grand Duke Mikhail, and then he refused to take the throne. That was only known on March 4th. I should have mentioned that as another variable here. There's supposed to be another monarch taking his place. The whole thing is complete nonsense. It still goes around. You know, the economy was growing at this period of time. The army was doing better. They shouldn't have been in that war in the first place. But this is how powerful the press was at the time. Kirill was the first one to refer to it as a coup. He did complain later on, and this shows you the nature of the situation, that from the first day when Kerensky takes over, he had to constantly provide explanations and instructions on issues relating to the current situation, making sure that he was loyal because he was very, very, very beloved. Also, so much for freedom. He was a powerful hierarch, and there was no real rising against him. The provisional government was in no position to do much about him. And there was Bishop Anatoly Kamensky, Tomsk, who actually served in the U.S. for quite a while in Minnesota and was a supporter of the Union of the Russian People. He spoke out against the new regime very quickly. He was ordered to explain himself. But he also said, "I consider it my duty of conscience to testify that neither I nor the clergy are conducting any agitation against the new regime. The accusation is either slander or misunderstanding." In other words, because he was opposed to it, people were saying that he wanted an uprising against it. Well, he didn't say that. He called it a coup. He wrote a letter to the Senate. He said, when Tomsk, the area, the region, learned of the coup and the confusion, "I made no statements, neither private nor public, and even was embarrassed to issue any orders within my department, including concerning who to commemorate now during the services." So a lot of people were just simply doing commemorating Grand Duke Nikolai Nikolaevich, Commander-in-Chief. So the church was so relevant that even the commemorations during liturgy were very important and very influential. And so the provisional state, again, it was a very weak government, whether from the Duma or elsewhere, that was extremely important to them. Here's what he said. This is Anatoly said this. "It's true, during the liturgy in the cathedral, I commemorated the heir to the throne, the Tsarevich, and his parents, the Grand Prince Mikhail Alexandrovich and Nikolai Nikolaevich, in view of the fact that, according to telegraph news, following the Tsar's abdication, the succession to the throne was to pass to Grand Prince Mikhail, leaving Tsarevich Alexei as an heir. This is the only fact that could have displeased some people, but it was not propaganda and did not meet with any protests." So there were many bishops who were opposed to it. As I mentioned before, there was one of two approaches to it. And unfortunately, the full support of Nicholas was very hard to find, showing the power of the media. But again, on March 5th, he published yet another appeal to his flock. Nothing against the provisional government. It was actually a leaflet more than anything else. He said, "No matter what forms the struggle of the popular parties on the royal throne may take, currently underway, we must remember that this struggle should not hinder our victory. Remember, there's World War I is going on." Putting it that way almost cleared him. Maybe that was taken as a veiled monarchist agitation. And he was eventually left alone. This was very, very confusing time. I've talked about roughly the same time in Ukraine many times on this show, Russia on this show. You're talking about only a year or so of endless chaos. Understanding it is very important because the rest of world history came from it. The worst he said was, he called for submission to the provisional government on the grounds that without a state, the country cannot exist. In other words, it's better than anarchy. He said the coup took us all by surprise, confronted each one of us with the question of which side to take, how to define ourselves politically, which party to join. We need to adhere to one party or another. We'd like to see a well-established and well-organized peasant people's party. A little random, but that shows you something about his ideology. these coups and revolutions were entirely, whether they be Masonic or Jewish, urban. But outwardly, he did act in basic support of the new government. Now, with all of that, he did repent of this. This is a man who, as the White Army was being defeated during the Civil War, he voluntarily returned to his diocese, which was under Soviet control, to maintain his pastoral duties. He knew he was going to be killed. Now, by a miracle, he survived many attacks. It's a great story, but only to be shot by the Stalinists in 1937. We all know the great Archbishop Anastasius Rubinovsky, who later led the Russian Orthodox Church abroad. The newspaper Bessarabian, and here's what he said. He's talking about saving the homeland and thus becoming like the sovereign emperor Nicholas Alexandrovich, who out of love for Russia renounced the throne of his most pious ancestors, relinquishing supreme power for the good of the common homeland. Let us recall the deeds of the sovereign, all that he accomplished in his way of the cross during his reign. Let us recall his final testament, with which he calls all faithful sons of the fatherland to fulfill their duty. Now, that did not sit well with the provisional government in the capital. The exchange that he had with the provisional state was kind of funny. I'm paraphrasing it here. But they asked him if they heard him right, you know, how you say that. It sounds like there's, you know, a rejection of the current authorities. Did I hear that right? Anastasius said, yeah, you heard that right. Now, that's not exactly what he said, but that's precisely what that conversation meant. When the news first hit his diocese, Chisinau, he said, when the people as a whole do not want to believe the news and come to terms with it, using the text of the manifesto, that is to say, the abdication, and try to clarify, the word is recognized correctly, but the usage is unclear to the listeners, that Emperor Nicholas II voluntarily abdicated supreme power for the good of the motherland. This word not only did not provoke an uprising among the people, but also brought notable peace. He then said in another address just before Pascha, he said he did call for submission to the provisional government to pray for it until the entire great Russian people gathers for the Constituent Assembly and elects the ruler. Those whose consciousness have not yet fully reconciled themselves with this so-called new order, we say that state power is, by its very nature, a divine institution, and that anarchy is harmful to both public and ecclesiastical life. So remember, he's the second guy to say that, well, we can't really do anything about this right now, but it's better than anarchy. There's the case of Bishop Andronicus Nikolsky of Perm. Now, he is one of the exceptions. He issued an appeal to all Orthodox people. He called this an interregnum. He did call for temporary obedience to the provisional government, because it's provisional. But he asked parishioners to beg God that he not leave us without a czar for long, like children without a father, and that God will provide Russia a new czar very soon. Well, there was a Committee of Public Safety in Perm, too. Yet again, Andronicus was one of these bishops who compared Nicholas II to the suffering Christ. That was very upsetting to them, which sounded like he was coming to the defense of the old order, which of course he was. He was asked to explain himself. This is what the Synod did at the time. And Lvov, its revolutionary head. What do you mean by that, basically? And he responded with dignity. Speaking of the new government, here's what he said. I submit to the government, the new government. However, I fear only one God. The terror created by the various committees and workers' councils and opposition to our calls for peace is leading to fatal anarchy. I was not afraid before to write the highest authorities and even personally to tell the Tsar of the urgent struggle against all untruth, that dangerous unrest is brewing among the people. I'm equally unafraid of the provisional government. He believed that the time is not far off when this coup will provoke popular indignation and more civil strife that the Germans will take advantage of. And, you know, it didn't satisfy Lvov or the Synod. Andronicus, when the abdication came through, he ordered the commemoration of Mikhail and Nikolai. On March 7th, the order was issued nationally to commemorate the new state. Andronicus then wrote to the chief prosecutor. He said, I've already sent you an explanation of my activities, which are, quote, dangerous in these times. I'm perplexed on the basis on which you find it possible to accuse me of inciting the people, not only against the provisional government, but against the ecclesiastical authorities in general. Well, obviously there's no incitement there, but he certainly rejects it. This is how he defended himself when he was challenged. He was challenged many times. He said, the act of abdication of the throne, Grand Duke Mikhail, legitimizing the provisional government, said that after the Constituent Assembly, we can have a czarist government, like any other, depending on what the Constituent Assembly will say. I submitted to the monarchy, I'll submit to the republic. Until that time, no citizen is deprived of the freedom to speak about any form of government at all for Russia. Otherwise, the assembly is superfluous. If someone has already irrevocably decided to question this form of government for Russia. His view and many other bishops were that, you know, Nicholas is gone. There's not much we could do about that. There are other members of the royal family, though. They had some very naive belief in the Constituent Assembly. It did form. Only left-wing parties were allowed to compete, and the turnout was like 25%. Of course, it didn't last long. I mean, it's true, the Bolsheviks had every reason to show contempt to it, although it was absolutely necessary for their existence. But after that, Andronicus was left in peace. And partially, this is because he enjoyed unquestioned authority in his diocese, laity and clergy. So if a bishop was too powerful, and if they could take advantage of a faction to be used against the bishop, they'll do it. But in many places, there wasn't. The diocesan congress in Perm, the diocesan synod, fully supported the bishop. He did remove leftist priests from parishes some time ago. Yeah, St. John of Kronstadt predicted all of this, and he nipped it in the bud. He was not a defender of the synodal order, the Petrine order. He was not a defender of the provisional government. He was a royalist, But he also was a realist, given the time period. He, Andronicus, just was not optimistic about the ability of the new government, amid the growing chaos, to resolve internal church problems and grant the church its long-awaited freedom. Both are going to be free again. Let me get to Anthony Kropovitsky, the great one, in Kharkov. Ruskaya Zhvin, the newspaper, published a sermon by him on March 6th, where he said, "I'm asked why I did not respond about whom one should now obey in civil life, and why they stopped commemorating the royal family in prayer. Let them not think that this silence, or what I'm about to say, was inspired by fear. From February 28th to March 3rd, I said nothing, because I did not know the will of the Tsar. His name continues to be commemorated everywhere." So on March 3rd, he started to commemorate Mikhail. Remember, the abdication document ordered obedience to the provisional government, which Anthony Kropovitsky cited. He said monarchists then should see the provisional government as legitimate because it was endorsed by him. Of course, it was not. He said no such thing, but there was no way for these men to know that at the time. There's a lot of confusion. One of the big areas of confusion was, on the one hand, the provisional government, and then the provisional committee of the State Duma, headed by Rozyanko. Two different things, very similar agenda. The State Duma was supposed to be this new constituent assembly. He also believed that, at a certain point, that both Mikhail and Nicholas renounced the governance of Russia voluntarily. So it's impossible to forcibly call on them by name. They lay down for themselves. If our Tsar had not renounced power and even languished in prison, then it would have exhorted you to stand for him and die for him. Depends on you if you wish to reestablish royal power in Russia, but in a legal manner through reasonable elections. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just extremely naive. It's no shock that a few days later, Anthony asked to be retired. He did not make a lot of open statements about the revolution. However, he did one thing that was very interesting. He advised his people to read the archpriest Butkevich's book, Lessons of the French Revolution, published in 1907, which I have read myself. It's very clear that it was very anti-revolutionary. So you have the most famous monarchist bishop in Russia being very, very careful. And it's because of this confusion. The list of things I gave you before shows why there is a confusion. No one was quite sure what was going to happen. So many bishops were investigated. Bishop Seraphim. It's another one. I mean, I go through so many of them. There were so many of these men at the time. Seraphim of Ekaterinburg. He was dismissed specifically for delivering a sermon on the revolutionary events. So again, there was no canonical order, assuming there was any canonical order before. They actually sent a team to investigate him. He was interrogated and everything else. There were 38 people who gave testimony. And it didn't go well for him very much. They accused him of the three great sins: monarchism, Rasputinism, and anti-Semitism. I'm not sure to what extent the Masonic membership of the Duma was known at the time. That's very hard to tell. He also called it a coup d'etat. He also said that when Nicholas abdicated, he thus untied our hands, after which I too considered myself entitled to go over to the side of the new government. But that optimism didn't last long. It's not like the provisionals were mowing people down in the street like the Bolsheviks did. So you had a totally different vibe when it came to their reactions. Yes, for those of you listening, I didn't use the word vibe. What I mean is the general attitude. And behind me is Chubba Purdy, my deaf Turkish Angora, who wants attention, but unfortunately I'm working. But the dismissal of Seraphim in this case wasn't just because of the things he said. As I mentioned before, there was a position of the local clergy. You had factions all over the place, unlike the other people I've mentioned. He apparently had very little authority in the diocese to begin with. Now, here's what the synod stated on March 9th. This was the official point of view on the provisional government. I'm quoting this from Vladimir Moss, by the way. The will of God has been accomplished in Russia. Russia has entered on a new path, a new state life. May God bless our great homeland with happiness and glory on its new path. For the sake of many sacrifices offered to win civil freedom, for the sake of the salvation of your own families, for the sake of the happiness of the homeland, abandon this great historical moment all quarrels, all disagreements. Unite in brotherly love for the good of Russia. Trust the provisional government, all together and everyone individually. Apply all your efforts to this end by your labors, exploits, prayers, obedience, and may help in this great work of introducing the new principles of state life. That is a clear and obvious endorsement. Bishops who were royalists, there were very few. They rejected this idea, as I mentioned them. Anthony Klapovitsky, Andronicus, as I mentioned. They fought Lvov over the issue. But, again, because the provisional government wasn't mowing people down in the street, they weren't, you know, burning churches down, there was a certain level of freedom of debate. Really, there was only one bishop who was removed explicitly for this. The formula for commemorations became the God-protected state and the pious provisional government, which is utterly absurd. That's the many years thing. How you could claim many years for a provisional government? It's provisional. Some people even just created their own forms of commemoration. And they made sure it was followed. The state made sure it was followed. And again, this is based on people believing that, the bishops believing that, that the abdication document was real. It wasn't written by Nicholas's generals with a fake signature. Because in that document it says to obey the provisional state. And it certainly was said by that very state many times over and over and over again. Now, we can't really talk about the sincerity of their appeals regarding the revolution and the new order. This is something very new. There's no czar now. It hasn't been the case in God knows how many millennia. The confusion was severe. It's absurd to believe that the overthrow of the autocracy was beneficial at all. There's a contemporary researcher named Mikhail Babkin, who was only in Russian. He says, the appeals heard from church pulpits and from the pages of diocesan newspapers urged the people to obey the new government, contributed to the formulation of a positive attitude towards the overthrow of the Romanov dynasty, and thereby effectively legitimized the February Revolution. Again, this is the result of media control. It's hard to agree with that point of view. Again, I thought the church was irrelevant. But, you know, it wasn't going to change very much. It's like anathematizing Lenin. Like that would bother him whatsoever, you know. The only reason I think they would do something like that is just to let people know what he really is, because the left always lies about its agenda. But you know what? They have no real alternative. What other scenario can we picture here? You put yourself in their position. Now, it's true, when you're ordained a bishop, it is expected of you that when things get hot, you sacrifice yourself. You may be a martyr. It goes with the job. But that's saying a lot. Any opposition to the revolution will bring a lot of trouble to themselves, but not too much. But it really had no impact as far as the diocese was concerned. Some bishops were more popular than others. And even the most royalist of them all said, you know, okay, we'll support the government because the alternative is worse and we're in a war now, etc. They weren't cowards or anything. They weren't servile, as Leon Trotsky later said. Obviously, these were men of great courage. The Stalinist repressions didn't break them, or those who survived. Not to mention the fact that the episcopacy didn't really know what happened to Tsar Nicholas. It was said in every newspaper that Nicholas and Mikhail Alexandrovich called for support for the new government. It was an absolute lie. And this is what Kropivitsky said. He said, well, okay, we could do that because of that. Because they're calling, you know, they're accepting this state as something that we should accept. So there was an appeal from the Kiev clergy signed by bishops and priests, stated that Nicholas II, by special decree, approved the provisional government which arose at the initiative of the State Duma. At the same time, in a manifesto signed on March 2nd, abdication manifesto, recognized the benefit of abdicating the throne. Further information was contained about Mikhail's refusal and an appeal. Submit to the provisional state as legally established. Now, it's true, Nicholas did appoint Prince Lvov as the chairman of the Council of Ministers. There's lots of Lvovs, by the way. It's like Golitsyn. There's lots of these people. But there was no provisional government at the time. Of course, he was still in power. Provisional government did see itself as socialist revolutionary. Kerensky was a very, very, very sleazy type. You see the pictures of him. He's a very sleazy man. It's like the governor of Minnesota when he was younger. He lived to an old age. I think in 1980 he died. The provisional government, even though they were atheists, they didn't want that known. Well, at least Rasputin doesn't rule here anymore, is what they would say. But Vladimir Moss is always, you know, very interesting. You know, this is how you cite people, by the way. What could they have done? What would you have done? I mean, was it possible to rally around the principle of the Orthodox autocracy? It had tremendous influence among the population, despite what the academics will say. Could you have anathematized anybody who accepted this government? Yes, they could have done that very easily. He mentions the example of the great patriarch Saint Grimalgin, who was on the cover of my book, Lectures on Medieval Russia, who was essentially starved to death in prison by the Poles. By the way, this is Chubba Purdy. She is a purebred Turkish Angora. She's deaf. She doesn't know how loud she's being. So she's just trying to help me out here, okay? It's okay. Something like Grimalgin had done. Liberating Russia from Polish rule and restoring the monarchy again in 1612. Could they have done something like that? Even calling the people to arms. But even just issuing an anathema, what would that have done? They didn't do that. I don't think they knew that the government was Masonic. Maybe Kerensky was, but not the government itself. However, you know, and I want to quote, again, I'm citing someone here. The opportunity was lost. The propaganda, the nonsense, the garbage, it's done their work. Some hierarchs supported the revolution, some rejected it. But the Synod as a unit sided with its supporters. There was no way really to create what Saint Grimalgin had done. But the conclusion is, again, very uncomfortable. The church in one form or another did renounce Tsarism, the pillars of Russian identity, the nature of Russia, the exception of very few bishops, as I mentioned, Macarius and Andronicus. Most of the hierarchy, matter of fact, the overwhelming majority of the hierarchy supported the Democrats and Freemasons. Here's what Bishop Gregory Grabe writes. There were few who understood at that moment that in accepting this coup, the Russian people had committed the sin of oath-breaking, had rejected the Tsar, the anointed of God, and had gone along the path of the prodigal son of the gospel, subjecting themselves to the same destructive consequences as he experienced on abandoning his father. Remember, this is something very new to them, and we need to keep that in mind. This is not something that sits well with a lot of people. It's unfortunate, but it's true. And their error will be compounded later on in the year with the October Revolution. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.